Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and in today's episode, I'm speaking with heart health nutritionist Michelle Rothenstein. Michelle and I speak about the four variables you need to monitor in order to keep an eye on your cardiovascular health, why lowering sodium is not always the way to go when it comes to managing blood pressure, and how we should look at saturated fats. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and please, if you like the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Michelle. Michelle Rothenstein, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
My true pleasure. And to kick us off, I would love to ask you, what is the number one thing you are excited for our listeners to learn today?
I just want individuals to realize that you can take control of your heart health if you take action early and you know your numbers, because heart disease is a silent disease, and without us knowing, it can silently brew. So I hope that individuals take the proactiveness and become empowered in their health in order to prevent complications in the future.
Wonderful. That sounds like a great takeaway. I'm excited to dig into all of that. And so on that note, tell me how you got into being a heart health nutritionist.
So I went to NYU and I was a pre-med major, and I had to decide in my junior year whether I was going to go to clinical residency as a doctor or clinical residency as a dietitian. And I was at this point of, well, I really want to help people. I really want to make sure that I can do everything I can to enhance people's lives. And so I went into the hospital in the rotations of both a dietitian and a doctor. And I found that in the Western medicine sphere, it was all about treatment. Here's a medication. Here's a medication that's going to treat it. And while medications are life-saving, I found that there was this big gap of prevention. And so that's when I decided to go into clinical residency as a nutritionist, as a dietitian, where it's very similar. We rotate between the ICU, the heart clinics, the weight loss clinics, the liver clinics, the kidney clinics, you name it. And I noticed this common pattern that any clinic you went to, like I went to the kidney clinic, and a lot of them were having heart disease complications, or they had an increased risk and they were having deaths from cardiovascular disease. And I saw this common pattern. And I took a step back and I looked at the research, and it really shows that, you know, the number one, year after year, the number one cause of death globally is cardiovascular disease, but 80 to 90% of it is preventable. And this kind of stuck us, like, it didn't make sense to me. How are we not preventing it if it's so preventable? So I kind of digged a little bit deeper, and, you know, I asked the doctors who I was in clinical rotation with, and a lot of times they would say to me, Michelle, patients are non-compliant. I'm like, patients don't want to be non-compliant. Patients want to live. They want to do everything they can to be compliant, but there is a gap in what's going on. So after my clinical residency, and I sat for my board exam, I did my master's degree. I actually took upon myself to do almost like a cardiology fellowship within nutrition. There's no really like course program for this, unfortunately. So I ended up working alongside electrophysiologists and lipidologists and preventative cardiologists and different types of heart specialists. And I took on the arm of the nutrition field. So while they were still treating them with medication, I kind of looked at the whole picture. Well, biologically, this is what's happening. This pathway is turning on or not getting enough support through certain nutrients. And if we actually focus into our targeted nutrition on that, we can improve patients' lives. We can reduce the need for medication. We can allow for better blood flow. We can ease the workload on our heart. We can reduce the plaque formation in the plumbing system of our heart. And we can also make our heart beat more regularly. So I went to conferences where doctors were like, this is a drug conference. Why are you here? I'm like, listen to the pathways. There's so many things nutrition has a focus on. And I worked alongside them to bring in the nutrition arm of it. I've seen the power of science-based nutrition, right? A lot of times clinicians and doctors want to see these randomized control studies on these patients, and you really can't take people and create a personalized science-based plan and put them in these randomized control settings. That's not how humans work. We're not mice. You can't control us like that. But the things that I've seen in my years of working alongside cardiologists is impactful, and really drives me to continue doing what I'm doing. So super, super love. I love what I do because I see the results it yields, and the power of science-based nutrition within protection of cardiovascular well-being.
I love all of that, and I love how passionate you are about prevention. I initially thought of going into, I studied exercise science, but part of that was kind of more oriented towards the elderly, towards recovery from sort of injury or from surgery and so on as well. And I did a few internships with that as well and noticed that it was often it, I don't well I do still enjoy working at that stage with people as well, but I would really wanted people to pre want wanted to help people prevent falls, wanted to help them prevent bad posture, wanted to keep them as healthy and active for as long as possible, not treat them or work with them when it's already quote unquote too late. So I totally get your motivation there. And so, you mentioned earlier, there are so many things we can do in order to prevent cardiovascular disease. And I mean, just really broadly speaking, what are those? Because I assume that there is a ton of them. But yeah, maybe you can give us an overview.
So the number one thing that I think people dismiss and don't realize the importance of is your blood pressure. You can get a $30 blood pressure cuff, check your blood pressure when you wake up, and assess what that value is. We know if it's even borderline high, meaning that it's high but doesn't require enough for medication intervention, it can cause damage to our endothelial lining, to the lining that protects our blood vessels, that can cause more plaque to form silently. So ideally, we're targeting blood pressure to be 110 over 70. And a lot of times, many people will go to the doctor and, it's an anxious setting. So blood pressure is high. It's called white coat syndrome. You get anxious in a more, offsetting environment. But then they just chalk it off. They're like, yeah, I'm nervous at the doctor's office. Of course, it's going to be high. And then they don't check it again until they come back the next year. And so they go years and years with actually true hypertension that was never properly addressed. So check your blood pressure at home. It's one of the easiest measurements to take. And I want you to check it in the morning, if it's normal for 2 weeks in the morning, so 110 over 70, awesome. Check it in the evening. If it's high, then we need to intervene. If it's optimal, great. Check it in the middle of the day. Check it at varying times to assess your body's response to the daily activities you're doing, and then we can intervene. It actually is one of the easiest metrics to lower with proper nutrition because there's so many things we can add to the diet to open up the arteries, to vasodilate them, which helps to lower blood pressure. But that one's really important because if we have silent blood pressure, it can cause plaque to form in the arteries. It can also cause heart failure, increase the workload on the heart, which can lead to heart failure in the future. And the third thing is it can actually cause arrhythmias and palpitations. So blood pressure is number one thing I really advise everybody to be checking and making sure that it is the appropriate value. I actually would advise you check it on both arms, and the one that's higher, that should be the arm that you always check because that's more of a true indication of what your blood pressure truly is. So blood pressure is one. Then there's also inflammation. So we can check it through a lab test called hsCRP. It's a really great lab test to assess, and our target is less than 1 milligrams per deciliter. So you can add that to, okay, I need to ask my doctor for hsCRP. But another thing is you can check your waist circumference. So many people, even if you are in a good weight or a BMI, you might have more of that weight around the abdominal region, which is your visceral fat. And that's very metabolic. Metabolically active. And when we're talking about heart disease, it is a cardiometabolic condition. And if we start having metabolic dysfunction, such as insulin resistance, increase in lipids, that can cause a lot of what I call havoc in the blood vessels that can lead to more plaque formation in the arteries. So, super important that we are checking for your waist circumference. So, get one of those soft measuring tapes. Don't suck in, don't suck out, and just put the two ends around your belly button. Preferably when you wake up. So, no food in your stomach. So, we take out the bloating factor if that's there and we address that. But if you have acid reflux, if you have eczema, if you have psoriasis, if you have any arthritis, if you have active forms of inflammation in your body, we need to address it. If you have high uric acid levels, gout, we need to assess what's causing the inflammation. And then we also need to focus on what we're adding to the diet because when we look at the anti-inflammatory index, there are a lot more foods that we need to add than to take away in order to improve inflammation. But we need to know it's there and it's silent. It's low-grade inflammation. We don't feel it. And so super important that we're checking for inflammation. So blood pressure is one, inflammation is another. The third thing I would say is your lipids. We need to make sure that your atherogenic cholesterol is low. So if you have a lot of LDL particles that are more susceptible to plaque formation, that can increase very readily, especially if you have genetic predisposition. So if someone has a high lipoprotein little A or they have a strong family history of heart disease, we want to make sure we're targeting that at much lower thresholds. You could check your atherogenic LDL by a marker called apolipoprotein B. ApoB. Many people may not have this test done because the physician may not be fully aware of it because it's very specialized when you think about cardiology and specifically lipidology. But if you don't have it, you can actually calculate a surrogate marker for ApoB on a standard lipid panel. So you could take your total cholesterol, you could subtract your HDL cholesterol from it, and it's called your non-HDL cholesterol. And that target should really be less than 100 milligrams per deciliter. That can be a surrogate marker. And then the next time you get blood tests, you can ask for an ApoB. You can ask for a lipoprotein little A to get those information. But in the meantime, there's still things you can do. So I know it's a lot. We have blood pressure, we have inflammation, we have lipids. We also have to look at blood sugar. We have to look at insulin resistance, and we have to also look at hemoglobin A1C. So hemoglobin A1C, if it's elevated, so if it's above 5.7%, it's a sign of prediabetes. If it's above 6.5%, it's a sign of type 2 diabetes. We know that your body's struggling to put glucose into the cell, and we must address it. Because if glucose is in the bloodstream, that's going to wreak havoc in the blood vessels as well. So we want to address that. But you know, some people have a normal hemoglobin A1C and they still have insulin resistance because you can be insulin resistant for up to a decade before you have an elevation in hemoglobin A1C because your body is pumping out more insulin. So it's helping to get the glucose inside, but you have elevations of insulin in your blood, which is not good for cardiovascular well-being. So we can check fasting insulin with a fasting glucose and then calculate your HOMA-IR, which is your insulin resistant marker. So we want to address that as well. There's a lot of different things that we need to address, and oftentimes they're very many people have all of these elevated. Some people have one elevated and then another one. If they don't address it, another one comes elevated. But it's important to look at the whole picture of things. All of these things matter when we're talking about cardiovascular health, because if you only look at one piece of the puzzle, you know, heart disease can show up in different forms in different people. So we want to take this comprehensive outlook and realize that your diet should help improve all of these. If you go on a diet where one goes up and one comes down, it's not optimizing your cardiovascular risk profile. And so whenever we do dietary interventions, I always recommend if you're these numbers are elevated, once you've implemented change for 3 months, retest them. If they're going in the wrong direction, we need to reassess what you're doing. And you should then kind of seek additional support if you need that to help optimize that from healthcare professionals who can help you and support your goals. I know, I think that there, like a lot of things are going around because there's so much different wrong, bad advice, I should say, from different influencers online. But I've heard things from functional medicine doctors where they tell their patients, yeah, cholesterol is going to go really high and then it's going to rebound and come back down. And I go, no, that's not how cholesterol works. If you are actually eating what you're supposed to be eating, it will always go in the right direction. It doesn't rebound. And so I always recommend, especially nowadays, to understand the why behind every recommendation, to understand why these things matter. Because without the understanding of why, people can get easily trapped into false information, and it can really negatively impact cardiovascular well-being. You don't feel blood pressure if it's borderline high. You don't feel inflammation if it's borderline high. You don't feel insulin resistance if it's borderline high. You do not feel your lipids high. You know, people say, I feel fine, so I'm fine. But it silently brews, and plaque can take years and decades to form. And we even see it in kids forming at as young as of age of 6 years old. So we know that it can take a long time to form. And if you have the genetic predisposition, it can actually form more aggressively. So we need to be looking at this as early as possible so that we can truly prevent cardiovascular disease and its complications that are associated with it.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for giving us a wonderful overview over these, what I think are four sort of specific areas we really want to look into. I want to dig into that first one, the blood pressure, because you also said it's quite practical and, you know, it's something we can measure ourselves at home. And I always love giving people some practical, actionable steps right away that they can implement straight away. And you mentioned it's so easy to influence that through nutrition. So, of course, I want to hear about your method. It's there. And I love what you said about focusing on what to add rather than just what to take away. Because I think so often in the quote unquote dieting space, people just think about what they should not be eating, what they need to cut out, and so on. And really, so hearing, you know, let's shift that to what we should add is really, really refreshing. So please tell us what we can add, what we can do in terms of nutrition to help our blood pressure.
So there's so many things. Blood pressure can rise from many different causes. One of the things that I like to start my clients with is really understanding how sodium works in the body. So oftentimes when you have high blood pressure, your doctor will mention to you, "Hey, go on a low sodium diet." And while there's truth to that, you have to understand what that actually means. I've seen many clients go to extremes where they go and look for 0 milligrams of sodium, and a lot of foods don't have that. So you end up not eating what actually helps your vascular health. But what people don't actually really focus on that should be focused on is that sodium doesn't work in the body alone. Sodium works with potassium. So sodium constricts the arteries. When we have above 500 milligrams of sodium, it actually can damage our endothelial lining, which could cause more of that micro tear and more of vascular tension in the arteries. Some people are salt sensitive, where they need to have a lot less sodium, or else their body will retain the sodium and lead to high blood pressure. So, sodium is an important picture here. But what a lot of people don't talk about is potassium. And so, sodium and potassium work in tandem together. If you have a meal that's high in sodium, but there's more potassium relative to sodium, then your body, your kidneys actually tell your body to release the sodium more effectively. So we are looking at adding in more potassium relative to sodium. And I think the first thing people think about when you say potassium is bananas. And I like to mention that there's actually a lot more foods that are rich in potassium, from our beets, our sweet potatoes, our prunes, our whole grains. There are nuts, our seeds, our beans, our legumes. There's so many different types of potassium that we can include in the diet that will help flush out sodium. With this being said, some people may have some kidney impairment. So if you have a kidney, you have kidney damage, if your eGFR, your estimated glomerular filtration rate is low, we do want, and your potassium levels in your blood tests are high, we do want to understand, you need to work with your healthcare professional to assess how much potassium you should be having in a day. It's not a low potassium diet or a no potassium diet. It's an adjusted potassium diet to help your body actually work with sodium and potassium to regulate vascular health. The same thing goes with potassium sparing medications. Many of my clients are on spironolactone or they're on Entresto, and these hold potassium in the body, and we need to make sure we're not overdoing potassium. But generally speaking, most people have very low volume of potassium in their diet. And if we focus more on the potassium-rich foods versus the sodium restriction, we're able to allow for better blood pressure control. This is also a tactic tactic I often tell my clients when you're eating at a restaurant, right? When you go to a restaurant, a lot of times people are like, well, oh, what am I going to order? I don't know what's heart healthy. And a lot of times I say, you can't know what oils they use. You're not going to be able to change that. You're not going to be able to change the amount of salt that's in pre-marinated food. It's not our tactic. Our tactic becomes, what can we add to this meal to help flush out that sodium that's there. And so looking at that, we can say, okay, maybe a baked potato is something we can add. Maybe we look at the side dishes of the menu and we see where can we add. Maybe there's steamed broccoli or there's a grilled asparagus or something that's going to help flush out the sodium that we can add in. A lot of salads are unfortunately still high in sodium because of all the cheese and all the other things they add to it. So I like to go to the side menu there. But we have to be looking kind of at what we're adding, because the potassium will help us to lower the load of the sodium of a given meal. So that's one tactic. Another tactic for blood pressure is improving nitric oxide production in the body. Nitric oxide helps to vasodilate our arteries, and there are certain foods that increase nitric oxide production, like our beets, our garlic, our arugula. But what's important to recognize is that our oral microbiome actually makes nitric oxide. And so if we don't have a good gut microbiome speaking to our oral microbiome, our body won't be able to necessarily make enough nitric oxide naturally. If you have plaque in your arteries, we actually need a lot more nitric oxide, because that depletes a lot of it. And as we age, our nitric oxide conversion also depletes too. So we need to assess kind of how your gut microbiome is, and making sure we're replenishing it with a lot of foods, and also giving the microbiome the necessary probiotics, prebiotics through food to help nourish it. You can actually test your nitric oxide strip, tests by putting a little bit of saliva on this nitric oxide test, almost like a pH, a urine test, and it will tell you if you're low, medium, or optimal. And you can do it right when you wake up for a series of a week or two. And that can help also guide you if that is one of the reasons why your blood pressure is elevated. So that's where I would start. But blood pressure can also be elevated from insulin resistance. When we are insulin resistant, our kidneys actually retain more sodium, and that causes a feedback loop to lead to high blood pressure too. It could be from inflammation. Remember, if there's anything in the blood vessel that's causing havoc, your heart has to work harder to pump blood throughout the body, and that's going to increase your blood pressure. So we have to assess what may be the cause of that. Is there just vascular tension? Is there not enough benefit from a vascular tone from nitric oxide? Is there over amounts of inflammation, insulin resistance? Is there plaque? Is there something that's causing these high elevations? And then we can intervene. I've had many clients come to me who have resistant hypertension. And what that means is the doctor gives you three different classes of blood pressure medication, and the blood pressure is still elevated. And and we strategize to see, well, what's the cause of it? And oftentimes it's insulin resistance or inflammation, or it's the nutrient deficiencies leading to poor vascular tone. And once we address it, they get off the medications because they weren't helping in the beginning, and their blood pressure is much lower. I've had a client who had PCOS. She had a lot. She had which is insulin resistance. In Most of the time. And she wanted to lose weight. Her waist was 60 inches when she first came to see me. She was struggling with weight loss. So she actually went on the ketogenic diet. And the ketogenic diet, she was like, Michelle, I'm not losing weight. My blood pressure is still high. My insulin resistance scores are still high. I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. And she went on the keto diet for about 3 months, and she was like, I don't know why my levels are actually trending in the wrong direction. I've cut in carbs, I've done all everything I could. And I said, because you're not addressing insulin resistance. By cutting out carbs, you don't address insulin resistance. You put a band-aid saying, hey, body, don't worry about how to digest carbs. That's A. But B, you're on a very high saturated fat diet, which actually can cause insulin resistance. And a lot of people don't don't know that understanding. It actually makes our cells less insulin sensitive. So it causes more of that issue. So we actually focus on having more of a balanced diet, focusing on meal timing, focusing on getting enough potassium, nitric oxide, magnesium, calcium, folate, the nutrients that she needed in the right pairing. And at first she hesitated because she's like, I haven't had carbs in a while. And then she's like, Michelle, I don't understand how this happened. She lost an inch every 2 weeks. She lost 1.5 pounds every week. Like she was on target. I'm like, I want you to take a second and realize how this is so beneficial to you. Within 2 weeks, she said, Michelle, my blood pressure has been the lowest it's ever been, like ever. And I said to her, well, look, you're feeding your body what it needs. You're giving your body the tools and the pairings in the right amounts and in the right frequency for it to digest the food, put it into the cell where it belongs, and then repeat that cycle. And when you do that, it thrives. And so I want you to take a second and realize this because there are going to be influencers who are always going to be pushing the keto diet. There's always going to be something. But look at how your body's responding to fueling your body and nourishing your body. I want you to take this time to be present to realize this because it's going to be paramount in longevity of a diet. I want when I work with my clients, it's so important that we're looking at this from a long-term perspective. Because if you just do this for a month or 2 months or 3 months, it's not going to protect your heart long-term. Heart disease is a progressive disease. So it needs to be something that we do on a regular and consistent basis in order for it to truly protect your heart health.
Michelle, I love everything you said, and there is so much to dig into. So, first of all, in regards to the sodium, I think if we're approaching our nutrition from a whole foods-based perspective, most foods cooked at home and we're not getting takeout all the time, we're not just relying on processed foods, then there is absolutely nothing wrong with adding some salt to your meals from time to time. I think the people are either one camp or the other, where they're just like, oh, don't worry about salt or sodium at all, it doesn't matter, or they're like terrified of adding salt to their meals. And I think especially the population that we also work with, you know, reasonably active, working out, wanting to gain muscle or perform well, we actually need that sodium. So I think if exactly to your point, like no fear mongering there, but rather what can we add to create that balance? So I really, really love that. And you actually got ahead of me because I was going to ask you about saturated fats and your take on that because I think when we're talking about heart health, the next thing almost always is sort of that debate about saturated fats. And again, here we usually have two camps. One camp that's saying like, oh, like give me all the butter and red meat and whatever. I don't even care, you know, 10 eggs for breakfast sort of thing. And then you have the other people that are like super low fat and terrified of any kind of red meat or whatever. So on that point, thank you firstly for pointing out how connected that is and that we do need to watch our saturated fats over. And but more so that it's actually also linked with insulin resistance, which I will be honest, I did not know that there was that connection. I always just thought it was more connected directly to heart health. So when it comes to saturated fats, how should we be thinking about our diet? Like in the sense of, do your clients eat red meat from time to time? What kind of oil slash butter or fats do they use? How do you want them to regulate those saturated fats?
Yeah, it's a good question. So this is a lot of where personalization needs to come in. If someone has familial hypercholesterolemia, which is a genetic metabolism disorder, also known as FH, the guidelines are a lot different. If someone has had a heart attack, the guidelines are much different. If someone has a high lipoprotein little a, the guidelines are different. If someone is at risk for heart disease higher than someone else, we need to take that into account. And I think this is where it gets really confusing because there's so many influencers who have no background in cardiovascular disease telling people that you can eat as much saturated fat as you want, and it's not tailored to specifically what someone needs. If somebody has had any of those, so a high FH score, if they had high Lp(a), if they have a cardiovascular event in their history, any of the or a high genetic predisposition to heart disease, I want to keep saturated fat low. And depending on their body weight, depending on their age, age, their gender, their labs, this can range from anywhere between 10 to 15 grams or even less, depending on the specific person. So if someone loves red meat and it's something that they are not going to give up, we need to be realistic about it, but we need to take into account how much saturated fat they need in that day and to count it towards that. But I want to bring up another point that no one really talks about either. Red meat, it's not just saturated fat. You can get very lean red meat. I have clients who have venison and who have elk, and I say to them, it's still red meat. And what I mean by that is when you eat large volumes of any red meat, whether it's high in saturated fat or it's not, your gut creates a byproduct called TMA, and your liver makes TMAO. And TMAO makes our arteries stiff and accelerates plaque formation. So red meat is never a you can eat as much as you want if it's lean when it comes to your heart health. So we still want to keep it low. You can actually test your markers, your TMA mar TMAO markers through a blood test to see where you are. We want it less than 6.2 UMs because that's the actual amount to make sure that we're not causing that acceleration. And so some people, depending on your risk factors, can include it. Others may not want to or not may not wish to do so. I do not prescribe the same diet to every single person. Some people say, what's the best diet? People say, are you going to make me vegan? And I say, it needs to be personalized because if I tell everyone to eat the same thing, no one's going to do this for the rest of your life. This is why diet fails. This is why a lot of doctors don't believe in diets because they don't understand how it needs to be personalized for longevity and for actual success. So if, I have many clients who come to me and say, I'm vegan, I want to stay vegan. And I go, okay, no problem. Let's make sure you have all the nutrients you need. I'm not a supplement pusher, but if you are vegan, you need to be on certain supplements in order to get all of the nutritional needs that your body needs to thrive. You know, I have many clients who say I tried being vegan, but then I felt really fatigued and I didn't feel good on a vegan diet. And I say, okay, you don't need to be vegan, but we still need to make sure that A, you're nutrient adequate. So you're getting all the vitamins, minerals, and macronutrients that your body needs. We also need to make sure that you are optimizing your cardiometabolic risk factors, given your culture, your lifestyle, your food preferences, and your day-to-day, right? If you're busy, you're not making every meal at home. It's okay to eat out, but you have to understand how that plays a role and what you can do to help optimize that, besides just eating a bunch of salads. I think a lot of people think, oh, she's just gonna make me eat salads. I personally don't love salads. So I really meet people where they are. And that's a big component when we talk about a heart healthy diet. It really looks at optimizing cardiometabolic health, getting your food to go into the cell where it belongs. So eating the right volumes of your fiber-rich carbohydrates, eating the right volumes of your lean protein for you, for your muscle health, for your heart health, for your cardiometabolic well-being. It's about having the complex starchy carbohydrate in the right volume because it's very nutrient dense and also incorporating healthy fat. But that's going to look different in every single one of my clients because they have different cultural preferences. They have different food preferences. They may have some allergies. Some may be celiac. There's many different things that are coming about here. And so at the end of the day, it's about nutrient adequacy within your lifestyle to ensure longevity of this plan, but making sure that your cardiometabolic risk factors are reduced not temporarily, but for the long haul. And that's a big factor in here too. So getting back to your saturated fat question, it really depends, right? If someone loves, like one of their joys is having on a weekend buttered eggs, I'm just making an example, we can incorporate that. But we're going to have to put some limits on the other things we're eating that day, especially if you're at a higher risk. And especially if you're struggling to optimize your lipid panel and your insulin resistance and you need that additional support, there will be adjustments to be made, but the amounts will all depend on you, your medical history, your family history, your genetic predisposition, your labs, your medications. There's so much things that go into this. And that's important to recognize too.
It's so great how you have such a personalized approach and that your approach is so focused on adherence, because you and I both know the best plan or prescription don't mean anything to the point of the person that you spoke to in the hospital. Compliance is so low. So, okay, well, then maybe it's not about the client, it's about the plan that we're giving them, right? So really great how personalized you're approaching all that. And to your point of the salads, I think often people just think, oh, what's healthy, a salad, but oftentimes the salad can be so laden with calories, it has blue cheese and nuts and sugared cranberries and whatever in there, and then you have your 1,000 calorie meal and you'd actually be better off with just a sandwich, and even though you might have been terrified of the carbs in the sandwich. But yeah, it's so funny. But
And
I
like
love
salads sometimes don't have anything in them. Like I've seen people be like, yeah, I have salads. I'm like, what's in your salad? And they're like, lettuce, a tomato, cucumber. I'm like, nutrient density. No, we don't.
Absolutely. No wonder you're not satiated or you're craving that muffin an hour later. Totally. I absolutely get that. But I want to highlight what you said there at the end, about the importance of healthy carbs and more specifically also fiber, because we know, or well, at least to my knowledge, fiber is also linked with heart health in general, or that that is very important, not just the minimization of saturated fats, but also the higher fiber content of our meals. Is that correct?
So fiber is really in our plant-based foods, and fiber does a lot of different things. So there are many different sources of fiber, and they all have different nutritional compositions, even to the detail of our vegetables. Not every vegetable has the same amount of these foods. Like, for instance, bell pepper is rich in vitamin C, but it's maybe not such a great source of folate, versus your green leafy vegetables have your folate. So there's a lot of nuance within the fiber department. But as a whole, when we incorporate both forms of soluble and insoluble fiber, we help to reduce our cholesterol levels. That's one. But we also nourish our gut microbiome. So, one of the, I talk about the gut a lot, but a lot of optimizing heart health has to do with gut health too, and bowel movements. I talk about bowel movements all the time in my practice. And I'm like, why do we stop talking about bowel movements as soon as like kids don't see their pediatrician anymore? Like, this should be a question that everyone asks. You learn so much from your bowel movement. And nobody really understands what's regular because no one talks about it. I like to use the Bristol stool chart to really make sure we're targeting it to a type 4. But fiber helps to feed the gut microbiome, feed the good bacteria, the foods it needs in order to flourish. And when that happens, we reduce inflammation associated with heart disease. That's one. We help to create short chain fatty acids called butyrate, which actually can help support blood pressure levels, support cholesterol levels, but reduce arterial stiffness. So, the stiffness in our arteries. We see a lot of benefit from plant-based foods, whether it's coming from our vegetables, our beans, our legumes, our nuts, our seeds, our whole grains. There's many sources, and they all matter in order to optimize our cardiovascular well-being because it helps nourish our gut, but it also helps with cholesterol. It also helps with insulin resistance. It also helps. So with underlying inflammation and blood pressure, there's so many benefits to it. So we definitely need to be adding more. And most people, like 95% of individuals, are not getting enough. So while someone will say, "Hey, I love vegetables and I eat vegetables," when I actually do a recall of what they're eating in a day, maybe they have one serving of vegetables throughout the whole day. And so we have to take inventory of what that actually looks like, and making sure we're getting a good variety in there to really optimize all benefits of fiber.
I can already tell you're such a wealth of knowledge and that there's so much more to dig into. Because of that, I'm really curious about your 6-week program that you have. So if people want to learn more from you and about all the amazing information that you have, of course, they should go and check out your social media, which I'm going to link in the show notes. But if they want to dig deeper, please tell us about your 6-week program.
Yeah, happy to. So, I have a 6-week heart optimization group program. I call it Optimize, and it actually takes into effect all of the aspects of your heart health and really digs into these underlying root causes in a lecture format, but also in an interactive format. So it's a high touch program where you have access to me to ask me your questions, show me what you're doing. I give feedback on it and really help to implement it. So we're talking about improving three functions of the heart. One is the pump, one is the plumbing, and one is the electrical. So we're helping to prevent and reduce the risk of heart failure. We're helping to reduce the and stabilize plaque formation in the arteries, atherosclerosis, and we're also helping with heartbeat regularity so we can stay in sinus rhythm and we don't have heart palpitations. And these are all based on science-based nutrition strategies. So week one, it's inflammation. Week two, we talk about insulin resistance. Week three is oxidative stress. Week four is better blood flow, where week five is lipids, and week six is micronutrient deficiencies and inadequacies. So it's very comprehensive. And I do that because I want individuals to feel empowered and have an action plan so that they can be proactive in their care, ask for the right labs, make sure that they're following their progress, adding in foods that improve their heart health, and seeing lasting results. So I love this program. This is going to be my 20th round. And it's just a really great community to be a part of and to learn from and to take that knowledge and apply it into your life.
What I love about it also is that it sounds like it's layered. And I think that's often so much better than if we just get like a bulk of information here, like here's the six things you need to implement all of these and change all of this from today to tomorrow. But like a week or however frequently you meet up with them sounds like a good time to kind of digest that first step and then focusing on the next step and layering it on top of it so that by the end of the time, you kind of feel like you have it all tied together.
Yeah, and I'm all about the small sustainable changes. So after each lecture, I give, hey, why don't we look at this? Like, can we start doing one or two of these goals? And that way, at the next lecture, you're continuing to add and add. And so you're seeing that you're doing a lot of things by the end of the program. So it's really about those small changes because when we look at habit formation, it needs to be slow and steady. It can't be an overall overnight because once you do a drastic change, it doesn't last. It's too overwhelming. It's too much work. It's too hard to do in a busy schedule. So, slow and steady is really, really important. And a big thing also is I'm a mom to four little boys, and I cannot spend hours in my kitchen. Like, I love doing things quick and easy, but also getting in all the good impact from it. So I'm really big about quick and easy meals, 15 tops. It's going to obviously require some work. It's not going to be no work, but you have, because anything you give into is going to require some time commitment, but it's not hours. It's not your whole Sunday meal prepping in your kitchen because that's not realistic. And it needs to fit in to a busy life because that's really the reality of most people who, is wanting to do these types of programs. And so it is all about how do we get the best bang for our buck in the limited time that we do have.
So wonderful, and I truly feel like you have enabled our listeners to learn what you set out at the beginning to give them some tools in terms of how they can approach their heart health today, basically, and give them some practical steps. So thank you so much for your time, Michelle. As I said, I will link all your handles in the show notes, and I'm just truly grateful for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michelle. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening.